And good morning. It's 8:06. I'm Connor Thomas filling in for Leslie on the local news hour today. She'll be back for the Sundance Reel at 9 a.m. It is January 30th, a Thursday here in Park City, my sister's birthday. So happy birthday, Jackie. I hope you're listening right now. Going to start off with a little bit of traffic. Looking at the Wasatch back, UDOT does not say there are any accidents or traffic barring the usual traffic on 224 and 248. However, they do say there's a vehicle fire by the White Barn on 224. It looks like that's northbound, so the side headed out of town. We don't have a good camera angle on it right now, so I can't tell you whether or not that's in the shoulder or the road. If you do know, it's 435-655-8255. You can call or text in. Would like to hear about that. But UDOT is not reporting any lanes blocked at the moment. Again, that's a vehicle fire on your way out of town on 224 by the White Barn. Apart from that, they're just reporting some delays on 248 and a little bit on US 40 northbound out of Heber. 248 looks a little bit more congested than 224 at the moment. Well, we were looking at a forecast of rain earlier in the week. That may have changed. And on the phone from ABC4's Meteorology Center, we have Cedric Haynes. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning. Yeah, we've got some quiet conditions today in terms of no rain or snow falling from the sky, but it's going to be all about some of that haze, which is going to try to sneak up into places like the Heber Valley and maybe even a little hint of that haze sneaking up into Park City today. But anywhere south of that, they're definitely going to be dealing with the code orange air quality conditions out there. Now, otherwise, temperatures will be very similar to what we've seen the past couple of days, with highs climbing back into the 30s after a frigid start this morning with those temperatures in the teens and low 20s. Now, as we go into the forecast for the next 24 hours, we're going to head back down into the teens again for us as we go into your Friday morning. But that's going to be the last really frigid morning that we're going to have for a while here, as we're going to be seeing a warming southerly wind kicking in as we go throughout the day on Friday. So look for partly cloudy skies as we go throughout your Friday, and we'll see those clouds on the increase by Friday afternoon and evening. Now, when we get to the weekend, that's when we start to see the bigger changes. Starting Friday night, we're going to be seeing areas of rain and snow beginning to make its way into the region. In the Heber Valley, it's probably going to be more of a rain-snow mix. But in Park City, we're definitely going to be looking at snow coming in, and we're looking at off and on snow. Some of that could be locally heavy at times in Park City, with highs only in the 30s. We may climb warm enough around 40 degrees in the Heber Valley. See a little rain mixed in the afternoon, but expect to start the day Saturday with snow coming down. And again, some of that snow could be on the heavy side. And then as we get into your Sunday, we're going to be looking at, again, more precipitation moving in. Some of that could be on the heavy side. Mainly rain in the Heber Valley, but as you get up towards Park City, that's where we could see still some snowflakes mixed in on Sunday. And that off and on pattern will continue with a rain-snow mix into your Monday, with highs in the 40s across the area and lows in the mid-30s. And then as we go into your Tuesday and Wednesday, we'll keep that chance of precipitation around in the form of a rain-snow mix each day. So the weather pattern does become much more active as we get into the weekend and beyond, as we start to see a atmospheric river of moisture moving in from the Pacific Ocean. That's going to kind of stall across northern Utah, and that's going to set the stage for multiple rounds of precipitation. So while it may not rain or snow throughout the entire day each day, we will definitely see different waves and periods of precipitation moving through from time to time. And even though temperatures for the most part will be warm through the weekend, there could be, especially for Saturday, the first half of Saturday, some slick spots and some trouble spots out there as some of that snow starts to come down, and some of that could be locally heavy with temperatures below freezing. After we get past about Saturday afternoon, for the most part, I'm expecting temperatures to actually hover at or above freezing, so we shouldn't see too many major roadway issues once we get past our Saturday afternoon. And again, looks like we stay with this pattern of active weather right on into the beginning of next week, so not much change once we start off with that active weather on Saturday.
All right, Cedric, thanks so much.
No, thank you.
And on the phone with me now is Drew Hardesty, forecaster at the Utah Avalanche Center. Drew, what's it look like in the backcountry today?
You know, morning. It's generally low avalanche danger on all aspects and elevations. We encourage you not to sleepwalk through a green danger rose, however, and there's always the fine print. Both loose, dry avalanches are possible on steep polar aspects. The snow surface is just so weak that it is becoming more and more cohesionless, and people are able to prod and trigger some even longer running, what we call dry loose snow avalanches or facet avalanches on the steep northerly facing aspects. Also with daytime warming and direct sun, even some wet loose avalanches are possible on the steep solar aspects. The winds have just been sort of merciless from the east and northeast the last several days. If you're in the high alpine, you may find a pocket of hard slab cross-loaded on some of the steeper alpine terrain. And just the as evidenced by the avalanche triggered on Sunday in the Provo Area Mountains, it's unlikely but not impossible to trigger an avalanche into old snow, old weak faceted snow, particularly in terrain that has already avalanched over the holidays and has been reloaded. That pocket was about 1 to 2 feet deep, about 150 feet wide. Close call, but no catch and carry. Generally low avalanche danger, but we're primed for rapidly increasing danger over the weekend with this upcoming storm.
All right. Well, thanks for keeping an eye out. Drew Hardesty from Utah Abbey. News Time's now 8:13. This is KPCW's Local News Hour. Well, coming up on the program, we'll speak with Summit County Councilmember Chris Robinson about yesterday's county council meeting. Then Leadership Park City Director Scott Van Hartsfeldt's in the studio to talk about this year's Leadership Symposium, formerly Leadership 101. Then the Arts Council of Park City and Summit County's Executive Director Jocelyn Scudder talks about this month's gallery stroll and upcoming local arts events and their master planning program. Then after that, at 9 a.m., it's back to the Sundance Reel with Leslie Thatcher. That's all coming up. Local news is next. Well, Lindsay Huntsman is the new Park City School District Superintendent. KPCW's Christine Weller has more on the 13-year district veteran.
The Board of Education appointed Lindsay Huntsman as the new superintendent during a special session Wednesday morning. Huntsman is the former director of the Career and Technical Education and Park City Centers for Advanced Professional Studies, or PCCAPS, programs. She has previously been a teacher, assistant principal, and principal. Huntsman said she's looking forward to creating safe spaces for students, opening communication with the community, and ensuring transparency.
It's impossible to move forward without being transparent. It's a must-do. In the past, we haven't been as transparent as we could have been. And I'm in a position now where we can do better, and we must do better, and we will do better.
Huntsman said she feels anxious, excited, and grateful to take on the role of superintendent.
We have a very supportive community, incredible teachers in the classroom, and amazing kiddos that we serve each day. And I'm just looking forward to moving us in the right direction.
Board President Meredith Reed said she and Vice President Nick Hill have been speaking and listening to staff, parents, and other community members since the election in November to understand what they want in a new superintendent. The board eventually asked the community for feedback through a survey and began working with the Utah School Boards Association to get guidance and input on how best to proceed.
We really just started with looking internally at who would be best to fill that, and then if we hadn't had good results from that process, we would have moved on to some other things, but we did.
Reed thanked former interim superintendent Caleb Fine for quickly taking on the difficult position.
He's done a great job of really shifting the tone around the district and being present in our schools and our community.
However, Reed said the board felt Huntsman was a better fit for permanent superintendent.
The experience that Lindsay has had across administrative positions, across programs, we really just felt that what Lindsay brought to the table and her leadership style was what we needed.
Fine will aid in Huntsman's transition to superintendent. He said he looks forward to working with her for many years in the district. Before becoming the interim superintendent, Fine was the principal of Treasure Mountain Junior High. However, the school will be decommissioned at the end of the school year. Eighth grade students will attend Ecker Hill Middle School, and ninth graders will move to Park City High School. Fine said he's unsure what his new role in the district will be, but he plans to help Huntsman settle in her role and looks forward to finding a new place. Christine Weller, KPCW News.
And on the phone with us now, we've got Summit County Councilmember Chris Robinson with a recap of yesterday's meeting. Good morning, Chris.
How are you, Connor?
Good. Hope you're well as well. Wanted to just jump off with a legislative update. We're into week 2 of the general session of the 2025 Utah Legislature. I know you've been tracking bills, probably speaking with state lawmakers. Before we talk about what has been introduced, is there anything that you've been hoping gets introduced that you haven't seen get introduced yet, or maybe things that haven't been introduced that you're all right with, not having passed this year?
I don't have anything specific in that regard. We're mainly monitoring the things that have been introduced and trying to, mend them, if that's the right word, to fit with what we're trying to do. There's a long list. I don't know if you want to start talking about and asking me questions about some, or you want me to dive into some, but...
I'll point out a couple that stuck out to me from yesterday's report, because that list has now gone on, I think, to 10 pages of what Deputy County Manager Jana Young's tracking. HB 88, housing policy amendments, that one stuck out to me because the moderate income housing plan is something the council seems to discuss quite often. If I read what she wrote correctly, this reduces the reporting requirement. So generally, you've got to report a moderate income housing plan to the state every year. This would be every 3 years. Is this them going easier on you? Why do you think they're reducing the reporting requirement?
I don't think it's a Summit County centric or instigated bill. I think that they, every 6 months was creating a lot of bureaucratic effort that's probably unnecessary. Maybe they have other methods, other things that they're going to institute that will make the reporting less, make more frequent reporting less necessary. I mean, we welcome it. We do spend a lot of time talking about it, because if we fail to file an acceptable report, then it affects, there are consequences that affect some of our funding and things. And those are the teeth that the state's put in for failure to comply. And so having longer time to comply is helpful.
Yeah, it's
between reports.
It's something that all the counties have to do. Could you maybe back up and explain when did you start having to file moderate income housing reports? Because it seems like this is the state's most powerful way of controlling housing policy across Utah. I guess short of upzoning everybody, this is kind of the way they do it, through this reporting requirement.
It's been a couple of years now. The state's really focusing on trying to get a lot more affordable housing. You heard the governor's state of the state, where, build, baby, build, and 35,000 new affordable home starts. And there are these strategies that each county and municipality of certain sizes have to adopt. As a menu, you have to adopt, 3 out of 20 or 5 out of 20. And they are things to encourage higher density, more affordability, streamlined processes, and so forth, to get more housing stock up on the market at the right price. And that the pressure's been turned up in the last 2 years or so.
And the plan is not just you identifying tools that you could use. There is a requirement that you do have to at some point build at this point, right?
Yeah, you have to choose these strategies. Like, one of them is to create a housing authority, which we've done. We've checked that box, and we worked on that yesterday some. But, at some point, it's got to result in rooftops.
Yeah, before we get to housing authority, I wanted to also bring up HB 256. This is that short-term rental bill. It was interesting to me because this would allow you to regulate short-term rentals more easily. Jury's out, I think, or the council has not decided what they want to do on short-term rentals yet. I gather there are some Summit County policies in the works. But this, what the deputy county manager said, is it would allow you to use online listings as evidence for, violations of county and whatever state code there might be that you're able to enforce. That's a change, right?
Yeah, I mean, the issue for us, Connor, is that we've got some 42,000 people in the county. We've got estimated some 5,200 short-term rentals or properties being used as such. We only have about 1,200 registered. And our hands have been tied with the tools that we could otherwise use to track down those that are not in compliance. And so this would free us up to use, there are means of figuring out where these, you know, unrecorded or unlicensed short-term rentals are taking place. But we're not, under current law, we don't have the ability to avail ourselves of those.
Yeah, I mean, do you know why you wouldn't have been able to use online listings as evidence of an active short-term rental? I mean, it seems like that's the only way that people advertise their short-term rentals.
You know, it was, maybe it's a Big Brother mentality or something that existed. The real estate industry is very fond of short-term rentals because they create a business model for home ownership. You know, you can build a town home or an apartment or something, duplex, and do that, but you can turn a single family home into a rental property, and with the higher rents at certain seasons that short-term rentals generate, it's pretty good deal. And so they're very protective of it, and the less regulation the better, and they have a lot of sway with powers that be on Capitol Hill, so there's a lot of protections for it. And but this one may, you know, this would be helpful. As you say, the county hasn't figured out exactly what further regulation we want to do, but at least at a minimum, for a health, safety, and welfare reason, and for an equity reason, they all ought to be licensed. They ought to have a business license. They ought to be paying transient room tax, and they ought to be regulated that way, and nothing else.
And that's the main thing that you would be looking at with these online listings. That would allow you to find the unlicensed ones.
Yeah. I mean, there are probably instances where they're being used as primary residences in violation of the requirements in some instances, too. So it's a double whammy. But against at least the revenue side of the county.
All right, let's move over to the Housing Authority discussion. You were noticed that you could approve some bylaws yesterday, but had some comments, and it looks like we'll approve it at a future date. You voted last year to create a Housing Authority. Is this the final step to actually do it, writing the bylaws that would govern the new organization?
Yes. These bylaws were mostly good. The changes that we wanted to make were, the primary one was to allow the county council to amend them in the future, but it would create a 5 to 7 person commission, housing commission, board members, and we're leaning toward 2 county council members, and then representatives from each of the 3 school districts. That would be 3 more, and then a couple of other positions, and it would allow us to get started, get organized. That group of 5 or 7 might propose additional bylaw amendments, and hopefully we would get some folks with some expertise among those 7 that are chosen.
Yeah, the cemetery board seems like one where you got folks that had a, you know, diverse range of skill sets that lended themselves well to planning something like a Snyderville Basin Cemetery. You talked about a lot of other examples of agencies that you've set up in the county before, especially High Valley Transit and North Summit Fire. And I wanted to ask about the difference in those governance structures, because I think you've got 2 council members on the High Valley Transit Board and still do. That was initially
3.
And that was initially what you did with North Summit Fire, but now those council members are off and they're more independent. What's the difference in philosophy between those 2 organizations, and which one do you see as the better model for a housing authority?
Well, in the case of North Summit, it had been existing for decades, but there was a lot of unrest and chaos over there. And the council decided that it would be good to sort it out, to expand the board, and 2 council members, namely Roger Armstrong and I, became members of the board. And then we went out and hired a new chief and instituted new policies and things. And actually, we had to raise a lot of money. There was a big tax increase because the all voluntary system wasn't working. Now that's stabilized. And as of the end of last year, Roger and I stepped off, and there won't be any county council membership, but we did that to try to right the ship. In the case of High Valley and in the case of this housing authority, those High Valley was, and this is, a fledgling operation that the county is spawning, and we want to make sure that it gets off to a great start. And so that's why we would, why we have retained seats in High Valley and why we want a couple here to make sure it's successful and to make the lines of communication between the council and the commissioner board pretty seamless, so that we can make sure we don't have any difficulties or have a shipwreck.
What do you think about the scope of the housing authority and what that looks like so far? I mean, bylaw's not approved yet, so nothing's final, but I don't want to put words in your mouth. You seemed like you've previously expressed interest in this developing a revenue stream for the county, or at least a revenue stream that could support its own operations, the housing authorities. What are your thoughts on that currently at this juncture?
Well, the housing authority, the commission for it, would have complete authority over, according to the bylaws that are yet to be approved, but as written, it have complete authority over the properties that would be within its ownership, and it would also have the ability to levy taxes and things, as I recall. I don't know on what tax base they would levy them, but I think what I'd like to see is, as we get developing either on our own account or in a partnership affordable housing, then we would, if we had this authority created, issuously decide, is this one we want to convey to the authority or not? Or is there some other way we want to hold title? And I do believe that over time that the cash flows, if we do these projects right, will inure to the benefit of future projects, or to allow us to grow the pie. And whether it's through ownership by the authority or otherwise.
Yeah, and I want to quickly touch on the public hearings last night before you go. The first one was on some requirements for the Snyderville Basin. New developments would have electric vehicle parking and bike parking, some encouragement of solar power as well. The other one regarding farm stands in the Snyderville Basin, based off the growing popularity of Copper Moose there by you on Old Ranch Road. You observed crickets with the public comment for the first one, and it was completely the opposite for the latter. A lot of people came out and had opinions on Copper Moose. Both resulted in you not taking a vote last night. Why do you want to reach out to more people for comment on the EV parking and bike stuff?
Well, what we're saying in that proposed code amendment for EV parking and so forth is that there's going to be a requirement that EV ready or actual hardwiring of EV chargers be placed in commercial, multifamily, and single family new construction. And I just thought it odd that, and we're making some fairly detailed requirements. I thought it odd that we would be doing something that would have a pretty big impact and not have a single member of the home building or the development community there giving any input. And I feared, and I think that some of my colleagues shared it, that what often happens there is we go ahead in our echo chamber and we pass something and nobody's paying any attention. And then when they go to do a project, they find out the code's changed and there's a requirement that nobody has really thought through. That's nobody that's in the that would be required to comply with it. So just wanted to make sure that we measured twice and cut once on that. In the case of Copper Moose, that's a very well-known thing with a lot of supporters, even those concerned about the ordinance creating farm stands in those, as a conditional use in those zones, have nothing but good to say about Copper Moose. It's a question of wanting to put guardrails on it, as we said, so that we don't get unintended consequences throughout the whole rural residential zoning district, where anyway, so I think it was, I think we did the right thing on both of those proposed ordinances.
Yep, more time to develop the code on those. They'll return as well as a resolution to create the Housing Authority bylaws. Chris, anything else you want to mention today?
No, I think I'm good. Thanks a lot, Connor.
You bet. Thanks for calling in. That was Summit County Councilmember Chris Robinson. Well, Utah's Department of Alcoholic Beverage Services is seeking business-minded residents to operate small liquor stores in Camas and Colville, along with dozens of other rural towns across the state. Here's KPCW's Parker Malatesta.
The DABS has 37 package agency contracts available to Utahns interested in operating liquor stores as independent contractors in rural areas of the state, including Camas and Colville. Package agencies are essentially small retail liquor stores that may be operated in hotels and resorts or less populated areas of the state where the alcohol market is sparse, as DABS Director Tiffany Klassen explains.
They're different from our state liquor stores, though, because they're not managed by us. They're managed by private citizens, and we approve these contracts in 3-year increments. So the new contract period is upon us, and so we're letting everyone know if you're a business owner or you've ever been interested in possibly having your own business as an independent contractor to run a package agency, now would be your time to get online and learn about the qualifications and to complete an application to be considered.
The open applications are for Type 2 and Type 3 package agencies. Type 2 stores are operated in conjunction with another business, like a convenience store, where the primary source of income is not liquor sales. Type 3 stores are often located in rural areas, farther away from state liquor stores. Utah law allows one package agency for every 18,000 residents. It's $125 to apply. Other requirements include a background check and a business plan outlining financial projections and marketing strategies. Contracts are subject to approval by the Alcoholic Beverage Services Commission. Commission Chair Steve Handy said they're looking for applicants who demonstrate good business management skills and understand the nature of the respective communities where they would operate. More information and the application form can be found online at kpcw.org. Parker Malatesta, KPCW News.
Here with me in studio now is Scott Van Hartsfeld, the leader of Leadership Park City. Good morning, Scott.
Good morning, Connor. How are you?
Good. So coming up next week, February 5th or 7th?
7th, on Friday.
All right. We got the former Leadership 101, now renamed to Leadership Symposium, or
Leadership
is it still 101?
Leadership Symposium. Nope, Leadership Symposium, but many of you will remember it as Leadership 101.
Gotcha. Is this your first time leading Leadership Symposium, or did you do it last year as well?
No, this is my first time.
All right. So, you know, what are some changes? What's the theme of this year's?
Yeah, it's so every year, this is an event that my predecessor, Miles Radiman, would put on. It's the largest event of the year for Leadership Park City that's available to the public. So like you said, it's February 7th from 9 to 4 o'clock. Breakfast and lunch are included in this. Right after I took the job, this was top of mind because it's such a big event. We have a lot of speakers who come in and a lot of people who attend. And it was about 2 weeks into the job that Miles actually invited me to Tina Lewis's memorial. And I never met Tina. I didn't know of her, which I'm a little embarrassed to say. But she was eulogized that day by some real giants in our community. Councilwoman Tolley was there. Tom Clyde eulogized her, past mayors, friends. And I was blown away to hear them talk about her. She's superhuman. I mean, to think of the things that she brought to this community. Sundance, she was intimately involved in bringing Sundance to the community. She established the historic preservation on Main Street. She helped bring the Olympics to us. She helped bring the Arts Festival. This single individual, this single human, that struck me like a bolt of lightning, that this is our legacy. This is who Park City is built on the shoulders of leaders who leaned in. She was just a citizen here, a resident here who took particular interest in this community and wanted to build it. She leaned in and she got it done. So that is the theme of this program, is the power of leadership in our community.
And it's organized around past, present, and future. It's been 2 years since I've been to one of these, and that's kind of how it goes usually, right?
It is, and it would always open with Miles. Miles would give this great history of Park City and how we've arrived at the place that we're at. I don't have the authority to tell that, so I brought in some real ringers. We're actually going to start off with, first, the mayor. Mayor Worrell is going to talk about her story of leadership and how she's arrived in the place that she is. And then we have Sally Elliott and Terry Orr are going to talk about, as Terry called it, because she wanted to make sure that I understood that while Tina was remarkable, she wasn't alone. Back in the 80s and in the 90s, we had an embarrassment of riches when it came to leaders. And so she called it Leaders with Pluck. That's going to be the title of her conversation. And she's going to tell some of those stories. So that will kind of set us up with the past. And then we have just a remarkable lineup of speakers who have kind of taken on that mantle and are working on issues that matter to this community today, right from the heart of it. So we're going to start with Caleb Fine talking about the schools and the school district. We're going to have an affordable housing panel led by Deputy County Manager Jana Young. That's going to include Jason Glidden from Mountainlands, Jamie Johnson, the CEO of the Park City Board of Realtors. Rhoda Stauffer is going to be there from the city. Jeff Jones from the Economic Development and Housing Director for the county. So really kind of getting into some of the affordable housing issues that we're working through as a community as we speak. We get into community belonging. Joel Zaro is going to be there with Diego and E.E. Sue talking about community belonging. Transportation, we've got this great transportation panel. I'm excited. Deputy City Manager Sarah Pierce is going to lead it. Caroline Rodriguez, Executive Director of High Valley Transit, who, by the way, I can tell stories. I have known Caroline for longer than all of you. I've known her since before she even moved to this community. And she is an absolute rock star. So and
that panel has Region 4 from UDOT,
yeah.
too, which if I get, that's Wasatch County, right? Or is that,
it's
region
actually
is Region
2. It's yeah. actually Region 2. So Robert Stewart's going to be there from
okay,
UDOT
gotcha.
and participating in that panel, which I think is a really good opportunity for the community to see some of the conversation and some of the healthy tension that exists between the city, High Valley Transit, UDOT, and how they're working together to try to solve some of the transportation issues. So really excited about that one. Tanya Hansen, Council Chair Tanya Hansen now from Summit County, is going to partner up with Mayor Zane from Oakley, which this I'm pretty excited about. They're going to talk about the eastern part of the county and the impact and some of the priorities that exist on the eastern part of the county, which I don't think we hear enough about. It, as part of my experience in leadership, that was a real eye-opener for me to get a little bit more exposure to that. So I'm really excited about that panel.
And to what extent do people on the east side of the county participate in Leadership Park City? It's got the Park City name, and so does that turn people off?
I hope not. I really hope not. We had some people from the eastern part of the county that participated in my class. One of my great friends, Bridget Hayes, was one of the people who really opened my eyes to some of the issues and the impact of the eastern part of the county. So they're part of our community, and we as a program open up access to the eastern part of the county as well.
Gotcha. So what's happening in the future part of the program?
I was terrified and excited to meet and have a conversation with Tom Clyde, who is such a legend in this community, and asked him with a trembling voice to lead and moderate a regional development panel, which he graciously agreed to do. So we're gonna do regional development. That's gonna have Councilman Ryan Dickey on it, former County Councilwoman Melina Stevens. Peter Barnes is gonna be on that, as well as Dustin Graybaugh, to talk about MIDA and some of the things that are going on that side of the mountain, which I'm really excited to hear the way that we are thinking about and managing regional growth in the future as we continue to see these new developments take shape. And then, you know, another remarkable human being, Colin Hilton, who really has led and driven the Olympic message for a couple generations in our community, is going to have a conversation about the Olympics and what we can expect going forward. He used his access and his influence to bring an Olympian. Megan Nick is going to be on that panel, as well as the aforementioned Tana Tolle. Candace Hart's going to be on that. And then the GM of Woodward, Gar Trainer. So really excited to hear about what that's going to look like.
Yeah, I want to ask you about the target audience of the Leadership Symposium, because you mentioned Dustin Graybaugh, the Wasatch County Manager, will be on one of the panels to talk about the Military Installation Development Authority. That's the agency in charge of the Deer Valley East Village expansion, for folks that don't know. You know, is this aimed more at Park City folks, Snyderville Basin area people? Who do you hope attends this?
Everyone. I hate to be so broad. Listen, if you've just moved to this community and you're hearing about some of these issues and you really want to dive in, this is a great opportunity. This provides access to you to the people who are working on these issues. You know, I want to quote the immortal Ted Lasso. Come curious, not judgmental. These are remarkable people. I've gotten to know almost every single person that's going to speak on February 7th. And they're really good at what they do. And they're really, really passionate about what they do. And so you get to hear directly from the people who are helping shape these issues. And I think it's a real opportunity for people. So whether you just moved here, regardless of where you live in the community, if you care about this community, or you've been here for generations, I think that there's going to be something for you in the program.
And we were talking just before we went on air, that I went to Leadership 101, I think 7 days after I moved here. It just kind of happened to coincide timing-wise. Earnest question for myself, is it worth it for someone like me to go back if I've already been to one of these?
Sure. Absolutely, I think it is. I think every year there are different speakers, and the people are going to be talking about the issues that you talk about every day on air. These names are probably very familiar to your listeners because they are working on issues that are very present in our community right now. So I think that I would hope that the way that we program this, it's going to be valuable to everybody. And we're going to feed you, which I think is important. So part of your ticket gives you breakfast and lunch. So you get to network a little bit, be around other like-minded community members.
Yeah, let's talk about ticketing. Yeah. What's the price this year? How do people sign up? Are tickets sold out? And do you expect that to happen?
I certainly hope that that happens. I want standing room only. Next year, I want to need a bigger room. So we can fit about 200 people at the Blair Education Center at the hospital. Tickets are not sold out yet. They're available through the Park City website. If you just look for the leadership tab on the Park City website, you'll find access to both the agenda with the entire lineup and every speaker, as well as access to tickets. So they're $50. And again, that comes with breakfast and lunch. So it's a full day. We start at 8:30, and actually, I'm sorry, we start at 9, where you can arrive for breakfast at 8:30, and we end at 4.
All right. We've been speaking with Scott Van Hartsfelt. He's the director of Leadership Park City. Scott, anything else you want to mention before you go off air?
I do. I knew you were going to ask me that. I just want to say, Miles has been in this community for a long time. And he's a legend. He built this program from scratch. They were really big shoes to step into. I've gotten an opportunity over the last 8 months to meet hundreds of people, many of them alumni, and to a person, they've been really encouraging and very kind to me. So I'm just extremely grateful to this community for welcoming me into this role. I could not do this, and I have to mention, I could not do this without my partner, Paige Galvin, who helps pull this together. And without the guidance of Matt Dias and Shane Scott and Janet Young and Jennifer West, so many people to name, but it's been really an honor to be welcomed in the way that I have. Thank you.
All right, Scott, thank you for coming on. Getting into a little bit of local news, the Wasatch County School District Board of Education announced the mascot for the district's second high school Tuesday. KPCW's Grace Dorfler reports.
The district announced the name for the new school on social media earlier this month, Deer Creek High School. The school colors will be navy, silver, and white. And on Tuesday, it shared the school's mascot, the Riverhawks. The district shared the survey numbers that drove the name and mascot picks. Just over half of the nearly 5,000 voters in the latest survey said Deer Creek was their favorite school name. A smaller number, around 2,500 people, voted in the mascot survey. The Riverhawks were the overwhelming favorite with 44% of votes. Superintendent Paul Sweat praised the board for listening to the community feedback.
We feel good about this, and I commend the board, like others have, that they did listen to their constituents and they did open this back up for a community vote. And I think this has turned out to be the right thing to do, and I think we've turned out with a great name and a great mascot for our new school.
A link to watch Tuesday's school board meeting is available at kpcw.org. Grace Dorfler, KPCW News.
Joining us in studio now is Jocelyn Scudder. She's the executive director of the Park City and Summit County Arts Council. Jocelyn, how's it going?
Good, thanks. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so you're in the middle of a master planning effort.
That we are.
What can you tell folks about this? There's a survey that they can take, and when will that close?
So the survey will close at the end of February. So this is our massive last push to get people's voices included in our survey. And for those of you who aren't familiar with the Arts and Culture Master Plan, so planning work is a big part of our job as a nonprofit arts council. We're always doing long-range planning to really try to make sure that we have a vision for the future of arts and culture in this community. Arts and culture is an economic stimulant for our local region, and it also benefits our quality of life. I can guarantee that every resident benefits from some type of arts and culture, whether it's culinary arts or performing arts or public art or visual art, right? So we're all touched by it, and it makes our quality of life better in this town. And this is an opportunity to contribute your voice. The survey is live on our website, pcscarts.org, or pcscartsplan.com. And it's really an opportunity for community members to say, hey, there is a gap in this. I don't see enough concerts, which I actually don't think that'll be the case because we have amazing performing arts organizations here. Or I want to see more public art, or I need more art classes for my students, or my Summit County youth. So it's a really important survey. It takes about 8 to 10 minutes to complete. It is translated into Spanish. And I don't know. I also acknowledge surveys can be sometimes the worst, but for those of you who have run surveys in your professional networks, you know they're extremely important and they really help us gather insightful data to make sure that we have a really accurate plan that reflects the voices of our community. So right now, if you are interested in this work, if you care about arts and culture, please go to pcscarts.org or pcscartsplan.com and take that survey. And then there are in-person, if this is something that really interests you and you like convening with the creative community, we're hosting these thought exchange workshops. February is really we're hitting community engagement really hard for this planning process. We're hosting 6 different free community workshops. We're calling them thought exchanges because really they're meant to have conversation. We will facilitate them, but we're going to really dive into some of the questions that we're asking in the survey to try to get extended, kind of deeper feedback than what we get in kind of a one answer survey. We're doing these on February 13th and 14th, and then February 27th and 28th with multiple different times per day, knowing that people's schedules differ. We want all people in the community to be able to participate in this, and they are free. And so we hope that you guys are interested in this and the community signs up for these. Again, you can go to our website, pcscarts.org, to register. And they will take place at Create PC, our local artist collective, which also, if you haven't been, it's a cool opportunity to check that out. And see the over 50 artists that are going to be displayed in that local artist collective.
Yeah, it's just north of 248 over there, kind of above Prospector, I guess, then.
Yeah, so Cray PC is tucked right behind Tupelo in 1500 Kearns and right behind the Wells Fargo. So a lot of people enter off of Monitor Drive. And that's we've got 2 floors there. The second floor has studios. The first floor is a gallery. And luckily, we've been able to really lean into the fact that we want our locals to have a part of this space. And so we get to host these community workshops there and gather people to talk big picture arts and culture.
Are there any demographics you're hoping to reach with the survey? Anybody that you don't usually hear from that you're really hoping takes it?
Not specifically, really. We want a wide range of demographics, age ranges. We did translate this survey into Spanish, and luckily through our programming with the Latino Arts Festival, we have a great connect with that local Latino community, so that's obviously a focus. And another focus is going to be youth. We obviously know that as we plan for the future, high school students and even younger are going to be affected by some of these plans and the long-range planning. And so we're actually working with some students in the Young Artists Academy who are interested in this work to make sure that we're getting some high school-aged voices, whether they're in the thought exchange workshops or in the survey.
Gotcha. And you're doing a gallery stroll tomorrow, last one of the month.
Yeah.
What can you tell us about anything special you're doing for the last one of January?
Definitely. So the last Friday gallery stroll, again, this happens 12 times a year. It happens every month, the last Friday. And there are, I think, around 14 or 15 galleries that are in the Gallery Association that participate in this stroll. And while some galleries, I think, may have closed down for Sundance, I know Trove Gallery had an activation for Sundance, but she's already setting up and she's going to be live for stroll. So it seems like Main Street's actually a little bit back in action. And so we just hope that community members come out and support the stroll. Brett Webster Images is running some really extraordinary Sundance specials for this month's stroll. And they have a large number of new works. Some exhibited 5 feet tall by 10 feet wide, massive pieces that are extremely exciting. Also on Main Street, Summit Gallery will be hosting Utah-based artist Kim Daw, and she will be live painting at the gallery from 6 to 8 p.m. Really great to see that live activation. And while there is a concentration of galleries on Main Street that participate in Stroll, we don't want you to forget about the off-main locations. The Kimball Art Center is in the Gallery Association and has a great show up right now. Create PC Local Artist Collective at 1500 Kearns, JG Art at the Prospect, and of course, William Cranstover Gallery out in Peoa. And I will notice JG Art Gallery is featuring the mystical wildlife and landscapes of Teresa Gray, and she will also be in attendance at the gallery on Friday night. And Create PC Local Artist Collective, every gallery stroll, we host open studios. So we have 10 studios upstairs, local artists in residence, where they have their paints displayed, their work on display, works in progress. And it's just really fun, at least in my opinion, to be able to go kind of spy on the creative process of these studios and meet some of these artists who are working professionally and have 24-hour access to these studios. And I will say, again, Create BC Local Artists Collective is an Arts Council program. And this is the last chance to see the Maker's Market, which is carried over from the holidays. We have jewelry and we have jams and tapenades and cookies and apparel in addition to fine art. So it's a really cool display of local creative goods. Over 40 Summit County makers are displayed in the Maker's Market, and it comes down this weekend. So hopefully you guys can come by.
And the new show going up February 7th at Create PC.
Yep, so we turned down the Maker's Market, and we are going to open our winter spring show on Friday, February 7th. It's wild that next week is February. I can't really put my hand around it. The party, we're having a launch party from 5 to 8 p.m. We're going to have cocktails, light bites. You can meet the artists. And again, so this party is going to be at Create PC Local Artist Collective, 1500 Kearns, 5 to 8 p.m. And we are going to retain some of those creative products, so that skincare, jewelry, prints, books, cards. That's actually via demand. We've had a lot of feedback that people love being able to find those gifty items in addition to finding fine art. And we also have some really amazing new fine artists. We have Alison Zundich, who does cyanotypes, Jeannie Baum, who has some new work in oil painting, Kevin Arthofer, excuse me, who has three-dimensional topographic art of Utah and Park City. Linda Holmes has a new body of abstract work. Lindsay Nash has really fun, whimsical, realist painting. And Quinn Cumming does block printing actually on clothing. So a really eclectic mix. This show that's opening on February 7th will be open for a few months, and it has over 50 artists displayed, a mix of fine art and also maker creative products.
All right. And I wanted to jump back right to the survey real quick, because you're the Park City Summit County Arts Council.
Correct.
Is the survey for you, or is it for the Public Arts Board? Like, who's going to be making the decisions based off some of the feedback that you get?
So we, as the Nonprofit Arts Council in this community, are managing and really facilitating this plan. We have hired a consultant out of Columbus, Ohio, actually. Their name is Designing Local. They are cultural planning experts. They've done cultural plans throughout the nation. They've actually done some work in Salt Lake City and Utah. And so while they are really, you know, kind of the brains behind the effort, and they are the ones, you know, putting together those surveys. But with feedback from us, we as an arts council are going to be managing, administering, and then also implementing this plan. It's really important that, you know, I think as of now, we're doing this community engagement, right? We're going to synthesize that data, hopefully have a really solid plan that we can bring to city council and county council this summer, and then have that really inform some next steps. And it's our job as an arts council to make sure that some of those goals and objectives are going to be implemented on. So it's absolutely going to be us making sure that we're managing it responsibly, and having goals that are actionable that we can bring partners in on. So we're really excited to lead this effort.
All right. We've been speaking with Jocelyn Scudder, Executive Director of Park City Summit County Arts Council. Thanks so much.
Thank you.